This is podcast number 141 for the Well-Educated Mother's Heart. Hi, I'm Marlene Peterson, and today I'm sharing Washington's Christmas gift to America. Before we move into month five, I want to share one more Christmas story from the life of George Washington. This story is taken from a 1922 book called Told in Story. That's a collection of American history brought to life stories written by some of the greatest writers of the day, such as Lew Wallace, who wrote Ben-Hur, Nathaniel Hawthorne, James Fenimore Cooper, and Washington Irving. Just a couple of reminders from the intro to that book. In spite of the fact that history is the most fascinating of studies, children usually find it dull and dry. The reason for this is obvious. History is human experience, and human experience must make its appeal to the imagination. The trained imagination needs no aid from fiction. To the untrained imagination, fiction, or some form of imaginative presentation, is necessary if history is to be anything more than the learning of facts that the child fails to visualize and bring in harmony with his own experience. The way to teach is by example. The child who reads Told in Story will have seen a picture of the toil, the hardship, the danger, the self-sacrifice which made the United States what it is. He should therefore be inspired to do his part in the upbuilding and safeguarding of the country. The selection I'm going to share now is entitled Washington Plucks Victory from Defeat. Just before the beginning of the Revolutionary War, the various colonies had sent delegates to Philadelphia to discuss the situation. This body was called the First Continental Congress. In May 1775, the Second Continental Congress met. It was only a body of delegates, but it became the government of the League of Colonies and elected George Washington Commander-in-Chief of the Colonial Army. Washington went to Boston and took command of the New England forces soon after the Battle of Bunker Hill. Reinforcements arrived from other colonies, and the army became the Army of America. Washington forced the British to sail away from Boston. They then turned to New York, which they wished to make the center of their power in America. Washington opposed them, but was defeated in the Battle of Long Island. Fort Washington, just north of New York, soon after surrendered with a large body of Patriot troops. These disasters almost overthrew the Patriot cause. On July 4, 1776, the colonies had declared themselves independent of the mother country and taken the name of the United States of America. But as the year 1776 drew to an end, the prospects of winning independence seemed small. Washington retreated across New Jersey to the Delaware River with a little army which dwindled away at every step. The English thought that the war would be over in a few weeks. The following description, taken from Paul Leister Ford's novel, Janus Meredith, describes the Christmas celebration of the German troops in the British Army and Washington's great victory over them. The story shows how Washington's soul rose indomitable above defeat and disaster and made the very cold and gloom of winter the means of winning a triumph that changed the history of America. This battle was the main turning point of the war. And now the selection. Part 1. Over in Trenton, the Hessian troops were celebrating Christmas with merrymakings. In the afternoon, after dinner, the three regiments of Anspach, Lossberg and Rahl, and the light horse with beating drums and flying colors paraded from one end of the town to the other, ending with a review in front of Rahl's headquarters. Following this, the regimental bands played a series of airs which the now disbanded rank and file joined in vocally. Then, as night and snow set in, a general move was made indoors at Rahl's quarters to the parlor, where a tall spruce tree, brilliant with lighted tallow candles and decorated with bits of colored paper, red-tinted eggs, and plunder from the town, drew cries of admiration from the people present. After a due enjoyment of the tree's beauty, the gifts were distributed, and then the company went to the dining room where the table sagged with the best that barnyard and pantry could produce, plus a perfect forest of bottles. The sight of such goodly plenty was delightful, and the cheer and merriment grew apace. Presently the fun grew until it began to verge on the riotous. Just as the uproar was at its greatest came a thundering at the door, and when it was opened a becloaked dragoon, white with snow, entered and gave Rawl a dispatch. The noise ceased for a moment as everyone paused to see what the dispatch was about. The commander was by this time so fuddled with drink that he could not so much as break the seal, much less read the contents, and another officer came to his assistance and read aloud as follows. Burlington, December 25th, 1776. Sir, by a spy just in, I have word that Mr. Washington, being informed of our troops having marched into winter quarters and having been reinforced by the arrival of a column under command of Sullivan, meditates an attack on some of our posts. I do not believe that in the present state of the river a crossing is possible, but be assured my information is true, and in case the ice clears, I advise you to be on your guard against a sudden attack on Trenton. I am, sir, your most obedient, humble servant, James Grant, Major General. Nine, grunted Rawl tipsily. I myself has word that Washington's men's has neither shoes nor blankets, and die mit cold and hunger. Dey will not cross to dis side, much ice or no ice, but if dey do, we make prisoners of dem. And once more the toasting and merrymaking was resumed. At the same hour that the Hessians were parading through the village streets, a horseman was speeding along the river road on the opposite side of the Delaware. As he came opposite the town, the blare of the horns sounded faintly across the water, and he checked his horse to listen for a moment, and then spurred on. 100 rods brought the rider within sight of the crossroad at Yardley's Ferry, just as a second horseman issued from it. The first hastily unbuckled and threw back his holster flap, even while he pressed his horse to come up with the new arrival. The latter, hearing the sound of hoofs, halted and twisted about in his saddle. "Well met, Prayerton," he called when the space between them had lessened. "I am seeking His Excellency, who, I was told, was to be found at Mackenkie's Ferry. Canst give me a guidance?" "You could find your way, Wilkinson," replied the handsome young staff officer addressed, "by following the track of Mercer's brigade. For the last 3 miles I could have kept the route, even if I knew not the road, by the bloody footprints of the Virginians. Look at the stains on the snow." "Poor fellows," responded Wilkinson feelingly. 7 miles they've marched today, with scarce a sound boot to accompany, and now they'll be marched back with not so much as a sight of the enemy. "You think the attack impossible?" asked Wilkinson. "Impossible," said Brereton. "Look at the rush of the ice, man. 'Twould be madness to attempt a crossing." The plan was for Caldwalder's brigade to attack Burlington at the same time we made our attempt, but I bring word from there that the river is impassable and the plan abandoned. "I thought the game was up when my general refused the command and set out for Philadelphia," remarked Wilkinson. "Gates is too good a politician and too little of a fighter to take forlorn hopes," sneered Brereton. "He leaves Washington to bear the risk and sets off to make favor with Congress, hoping, I have little doubt, that another defeat will serve to put him in the saddle." A half hour brought the two officers to their destination, a rude wooden pier used to conduct teams to the ferry boat. Now, however, ice was drifted and wedged in layers and hummocks some feet beyond its end, and outside this rushed the river, black and silent, save for the dull crunch of the ice floes as they ground against one another in their race downstream. On the end of the dock stood a tall and majestic figure, draped in a cloak, watching a number of men, who, with pick and axe, were cutting away the lodged ice that blocked the pier. Already a variety of boats, being filled with men, could be seen at each point of the shore, where the ground ice made embarkation possible. Along the bank, groups of soldiers were clustered about fires of fence rails wherever timber or wall offered the slightest shelter. Dismounting, the two aides walked to the dock and gave their letters to the tall man, who was no other than George Washington, commander of the American army. The disasters of the campaign had left their marks on his grave, strong face, but it was still calm and confident, even at this moment when the cause seemed on the point of utter breakdown. Taking the papers, Washington gave a final word to the sappers and miners. "Look alive there, men. Every minute now is worth an hour tomorrow." And followed by Brereton, he walked to the ferry house that he might find light with which to read the dispatches. By the aid of a smoky lantern, he glanced hastily through the two letters. "General Gates leaves to us all the honor to be gained tonight. Colonel Caldwalder declares it impossible to get his guns across," he told his aide, without a trace of emotion in his voice. Then his eyes flashed with a sudden exultation as he went on. "It seems there are some in our own force, as well as the enemy, who need a lesson in winter campaigning." "Then Your Excellency intends to attempt a crossing?" asked Brereton. "We shall attack Trenton before daybreak, and as we are likely to have a cold and wet march, stay you within doors and warm yourself after your ride. You are not needed, and there is a good fire in the kitchen." Brereton, with a shake of his head, stepped from the hallway into the kitchen. Only one man was in the room, and he, seated at the table, was occupied in rolling cartridges. It was a friend, McClure, a preacher. "Hope Harson, this is a new work for you," greeted Brereton. "Yes, making cartridges with the leaves of Watts' hymns." "Good, no danger of those cartridges getting wet, for Watts will never be anything but dry." "Tut, tut," reproved the clergyman. "Dry or not, he has done God's work in the past, and, with the aid of heaven, he'll do it again tonight." The rumble of artillery at this point warned the aide that the embarkation was actually beginning, and hastily catching up the cartridges already made, he unbuttoned the flannel shirt he wore and stuffed them in. Throwing his cloak about him, he hurried out. Part 2. The ice had finally been removed and a hay barge dragged up to the pier. Without delay, 2 12-pounders were rolled upon it, with their men and horses, and leaving further superintendents of the embarkation to Generals Green and Knox, Washington and his staff took their places between the guns. 2 row galleys having made fast to the front, the men in them bent to the oars, and the barge moved slowly from the shore. Its start was the signal to all the other craft to put off. The instant the shelter of the land was lost, the struggle with the elements began. The wind, blowing savagely from the northeast, swept upon them, and churning the river into foam, drove the bitterly cold spray against man and beast. Masses of ice, impelled by the current and blast, were only kept from colliding with the boat by the artillerymen, who, with the rammers and sponges of the guns, thrust them back, while the bowsmen in the galleys had much ado to keep a space clear for the oars to swing. To make it worse, before 50 yards had been covered, the air was filled with snow, now sweeping one way and now another, shutting off all sight of the shores and making the rushing current of the black, sullen river the sole means by which direction could be judged. "What horrible weather," said Brereton. Washington turned to him. "Be thankful you've something between you and the river, my boy. 24 years ago, this very week, I was returning from a mission to the French on the Ohio, and to cross a river we made a raft of logs. I was poling, and the current threw the raft with so much violence against the pole that it jerked me out into 10 feet of water, and I was like to have drowned. This wind and sleet seem warm when I remember that. And had Gates and Caldwalader been there, the storm and ice tonight would not have seemed to them such obstacles. 'Twas my first public service," he added, after a slight pause. "Who knows that tonight may not be my last?" "'Tis ever a possibility," spoke up Webb, "since Your Excellency is so reckless in exposing yourself to the enemy's fire." Washington shrugged his shoulder, but gave no answer. Departure had been taken from the Pennsylvania shore before 10, but ice, wind, and current made the crossing so laborious and slow that a landing of the first detachment was not effected until nearly 12. Then the boats went back for their second load, the advance meanwhile huddling together wherever there was the slightest shelter from the blast and hail that was now cutting mercilessly. Not till 3 o'clock did the 2nd Division land, and another hour was lost in the formation of the column. At last, however, the order to march was given, and the 2,400 weary, soaked, and well-nigh frozen men set off through the blinding storm on the 9-mile march to Trenton. At Yardley's Ferry, the force divided, Sullivan's division keeping to the river turnpike, intending to enter Trenton from the south, while the main division took the crossroad so as to come out to the north of the town, the plan being to place the enemy thus between two fires. Owing to the delay in crossing the river, it was daylight when the outskirts of the town were reached, but the falling snow veiled the advance, and here the column halted temporarily to permit of scouting. While the troops stood at ease, an aide from Sullivan's detachment reported that it had arrived on the other side of the village and was ready for the attack, save that their cartridges were too wet for use. "Very well, sir," ordered Washington. "Return and tell General Sullivan he must rely on the bayonet." "Your Excellency," said Colonel Hand, stepping up, "my regiment is in the same plight, and our rifles carry no bayonets." "Here are some dry cartridges," said Brereton, unbuttoning his shirt. "Let your men draw their charges and reload, Colonel Hand," commanded Washington. In a moment the order to advance was given, and the column opened out on the post road leading toward Princeton. The first sign of life was a man in a front yard engaged in cutting wood. The commander-in-chief, who was leading the advance, called to him, "Which way is the Hessian picket?" "Find out yourself," retorted the chopper. "Speak out, man," roared Webb hotly. "This is General Washington." "God bless and prosper you, sir," shouted the man. "Follow me and I'll show you," he added, starting down the road at a run. As he came to the house, without a pause, he swung his axe and burst open the door with a single blow. "Come in," he shrieked, and darted in, followed by some of the riflemen. Leaving them to secure the picket, the regiments went forward just as a desultory firing from the front showed that the alarm had been given by Sullivan's attack. Pushing on, they gained a sight of the enemy, a confused mass of men some 300 yards away. But in front of them, two guns were already being wheeled into position by the artillerists, with the obvious purpose of checking the advance until the regiments had time to form. "Capture the battery," came the stern voice of the commander. "Forward, double quick," shouted Colonel Hand. Brereton, putting spurs to his horse, joined in the rush of the men as the regiment broke into a run. "Look out," Handy yelled. "They'll be ready to fire before we can get there, and in this narrow road we'll be cut in pieces. Give them a dose of Watts." "Halt," roared Hand, and then in quick succession came the order, "Take aim, fire." "Hurrah for the hymns," cheered Brereton, as a number of the gunners fell, and the remainder, deserting the cannon, fell back on the infantry. "Come on," he roared, as the Virginia Light Horse, taking advantage of an open field, raced the riflemen to the guns. Barely were they reached when a mounted officer rode up to the Hessian regiments and cried, "Forwards," waving his sword toward the cannon. "We can't hold the guns against them," yelled Brereton. "Over with them, men." In an instant, the soldiers with rifles and the cavalry with the rammers that had been dropped clustered about the cannon, some prying and some lifting. Before the foe could reach them, the two pieces of artillery were tipped over and rolled into the ditch. The Americans scattered the moment the guns were made useless to the British. This gave the Continental infantry in the rear their opportunity, and they poured in a scathing volley, quickly followed by the roar of Captain Forrest's artillery, which unlimbered and opened fire. A wild confusion followed, the enemy advancing until the American regiments charged them in the face of their volleys. Upon this they broke and, falling back in disorder, tried to escape to the east road through an orchard. Stevens' brigade and Hand's riflemen headed them off. Flight in this direction made impossible. The enemy retreated toward the town, but the column under Sullivan blocked this outlet. Forrest's cannon were pushed forward. Washington rode with them, utterly unheeding of both the enemy fire and of the protests of his staff. Showing the new position for the guns, he ordered them loaded with canister. Captain Forrest himself stooped to sight one of the cannon, then cried, "Sir, they have struck." "Struck!" exclaimed Washington. "Yes, their colors are down and they have grounded their arms." Washington cantered toward the enemy. "Your Excellency," shouted an officer, "the Hessians have surrendered. Here is Colonel Rahl." Washington rode to where, supported by two sergeants, the officer stood, his brilliant uniform darkened by the blood flowing from two wounds, and took from his hand the sword the Hessian commander, with bowed head, due to both shame and faintness, held out to him. "Let his wounds have attention," the general ordered. Wheeling his horse, he looked at the three regiments of Hessians. "'Tis a glorious day for our country," he said, the personal triumph already forgotten in the greater one. By the way, I found this little footnote that's worth noting in the Eggleston story of Washington about what about the treatment of the Hessians following this. They said that the people might realize how much of a victory had been won. The Hessian prisoners were marched through Philadelphia. They were sent to Virginia for safekeeping, and everywhere that they went, they were hooted at by the crowd for hiring themselves out to kill American freemen. Old women especially scolded them soundly. When Washington heard of this, he caused notices to be posted in the towns through which the prisoners passed, informing the people that the Hessians had not come to America of their own free will, but were forced to do so, and should therefore be treated as friends rather than enemies. After this, no more old women berated the unfortunate Germans, but old and young brought them food and treated them kindly. The Battle of Trenton caused great joy in America and revived the drooping spirits of the people. But when Congress praised Washington for his success, he modestly answered that the other officers deserved as much praise as he did. We'll continue our story of the Revolution next month. But for now, crossing the Delaware was George Washington's Merry Christmas present to America, something that could only have been gifted by a great man of virtue. Bye-bye. See you next time.